It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson, in for Kate Archer Kent. According to our next guest, humanity faces an existential crisis in a very literal sense because no one is addressing a simple question that has been fundamental to artificial intelligence since its very inception. What happens to society when we transfer power to a system built by a small group of people that is designed to make decisions for everyone? We're surrounded by artificial intelligence, or AI, practically everywhere we go. What's it doing? Who's it answering to? What's next for humanity? That's what we're going to talk about this morning with Amy Webb, author of The Big Nine, How the Tech Titans and Their Thinking Machines Could Warp Humanity. Do you use artificial intelligence in your day-to-day life? What features do you like? Do you use any facial recognition software, fingerprint scanners, virtual assistants like Siri or Alexa? Do any of these technologies give you pause or make you uneasy? Do you wonder if tech companies know too much about us or that they're shaping how we interact and live? What questions do you have about being a responsible tech user and about the future of artificial intelligence? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, ideas@WPR.org, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Amy Webb is a professor of strategic foresight at the NYU Stern School of Business. She founded the Future Today Institute and is the author of The Big Nine, How the Tech Titans and Their Thinking Machines Could Warp Humanity. Amy, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Your book is titled The Big Nine. Who are these nine companies you talk about, and how did they land themselves in this elite and powerful cohort?
So there are lots of different startups and organizations all around the world that are working in some way on artificial intelligence. However, there are nine companies distributed between the United States and China that overwhelmingly have the lion's share of patents. They are able to command the most money in the marketplace. They have the best partnerships with the best universities. They can attract top talent. They're even building out custom frameworks and silicon, and of course algorithms and databases. So it's these nine companies that matter most, and ultimately all roads in AI in some point lead up to them. So there are three in China. Those are called the BAT, Baidu, Alibaba, and Tencent. And they're not well-known companies in the United States, but they are analogous to a lot of our most popular big tech companies. So you can think of Alibaba in a similar way to Amazon. You can think of Baidu in many ways as similar to Google. And Tencent is a bit of a different kind of beast. It's part social network. It's a gaming service. It also facilitates payments and is in the healthcare space. So that's China. And those are independent, publicly traded companies. But because it's China and that's where they are domiciled, they're very much under the thumb of Beijing. In the U.S., we have the six what I call G-Mafia companies. So those are Google, Amazon, Microsoft, Facebook, IBM, and Apple. And, of course, these are also publicly traded companies. But because in the United States there's a transactional relationship on the best days and acrimonious on many other occasions, relationship that these companies have with Washington, D.C., they operate very independently from, regulation, from what's happening on the Hill, and they are driven by market demands.
Okay, so market demands driving the G Mafia and government goals and intentions governing or driving things in China, but ultimately everybody is after whatever the holy grail is of AI, aren't they? Regardless of their motivations.
Well, it's good to. Yes, that's in part true, but it's good to think about artificial intelligence not as a singular technology with some distant horizon time frame, but instead as artificial intelligence as a collection of different technologies, like a constellation of them that work together. And it has been in some form of development for quite a while. So this is the, you could think of it as the third era of computing. So if the first era in computing was tabulation in the mid-1800s, and the more modern era had to do with programmable systems, that would be your, you know, your laptops, you know, your mobile devices. But this next era is autonomous decision making, and that's really what artificial intelligence is. AI is nothing more than a system designed to make automatic decisions using data on behalf of us. And some of those decisions are made in very narrow ways, like when you back up your car. If you have a newer car, you may have a screen on your dashboard that shows you what's in the way, and you might hear some beeping if there's a possible obstruction. That's an example of narrow artificial intelligence. We're already sort of surrounded by AI. It's already here. And what these companies are, I think, after is, you know, all of the different technologies and processes and opportunities that artificial intelligence can help bring to fruition.
We're talking about the tech giants and their impact with Amy Webb. She's a professor of strategic foresight and author of The Big Nine, How the Tech Titans and Their Thinking Machines Could Warp Humanity. Do you use artificial intelligence in your day-to-day? I mean, when you think about it, probably we do without even realizing it. What features do you like? Do you use facial recognition software, fingerprint scanners, virtual assistants like Siri or Alexa? Do any of these technologies give you pause or make you uneasy? Do you wonder if tech companies might know, well, just a little too much about us, or that they're shaping how we interact and live? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, ideas@WPR.org, or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Amy, you point out how a lot of these companies face high demands from investors and make decisions based on market forces and politics rather than being able to take time and think about what might just be the best thing long term. How do you think these short term decisions will impact society in the long term?
You know, in the United States, we don't really have a strong tradition of long term planning. And I think we're starting to see the negative impacts of that. You know, in the U.S., we I would argue, have three epicenters of power. We have Washington, D.C., and, you know, the executive branch and Congress and the judiciary. However, we also have a financial center, and that's in New York City, which also commands a tremendous amount of power. And we have the tech sector, based primarily in Silicon Valley, but also in the Pacific Northwest. So I would argue that those three epicenters of power are both codependent and in many ways equally balanced, which is a way of saying that Washington, D.C. doesn't work without our financial center and the tech center. The tech center is dependent on the financial center and has to figure out how to work better with D.C. And the finance guys, you know, are thinking about, obviously, regulation and, you know, and it's the technology that helps them do their jobs. I say this because in none of those three places do we see long-term planning. There is no office designated. We don't have a cultural tradition like we see in Asia of long-term strategic planning. And you know, that is causing some of the issues, that has caused some of the issues that we see today.
We'll pick up this conversation in a moment with Amy Webb and with you if you care to join us at 800-642-1234. What are your questions or concerns about the development of artificial intelligence? I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. We're talking about the future of humanity and its relationship to the development and implementation of artificial intelligence, or AI as it's more popularly known. How are you using AI in your personal or professional life? Does it make you uneasy? Are you comfortable with it? What are your hopes and concerns about the future of this technology and how it will affect our lives? 800-642 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Ideas at WPR.org. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Amy Webb is with us. Amy is a professor of strategic foresight at the NYU Stern School of Business. We have an email from Sandra in Baraboo who says, AI freaks her out. Watched History Channel documentary that said Facebook had made different AI systems and didn't instruct them to communicate with each other. Then they ended up communicating with each other and they had to shut them down. That almost sounds like something out of William Gibson's Necromancer, Amy.
Yeah, you know, when it comes to AI, there's a lot of misplaced optimism and fear. And I think that when we hear about new research, that can scare people. There is a field of artificial intelligence called generative There is a piece of the ecosystem called generative adversarial networks. And essentially, this is where systems look for anomalies and then try to create something new or different. It's a way to train systems. Sometimes it leads to terrifying sounding headlines like an AI system invented its own language to try to communicate with other AI systems and humans were left out of the loop. This is why it's super important, I think, for everybody to spend just a few minutes to understand and learn about what artificial intelligence is, because it's not all that complicated and you don't have to have a technical degree to learn a little bit more. My strong advice would be to just read a little bit so that you have some context the next time you see stories like that.
Thanks for that email. Let's go to the phones. Chris is with us in Port Wayne. Chris, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Great show. As someone who's interested in ethics and studies the applications of military technologies and computers, I've become aware that, you know, the facial recognition techniques that drones use do a top-down. They can identify you supposedly from the top of your head. And now the Pentagon's moving towards the approval of AI techniques that would give the decision to kill or not kill based on the machine's decision. Right now, of course, we've got the drone pilots in Colorado killing people in Afghanistan with a human element. The human has to decide, kill or not kill. That's probably a good idea. The idea that the Pentagon is pushing for having the artificial intelligence device make the kill or not kill decision is ethically very questionable, and we should take that sort of ethical approach to a lot of the use of these techniques before they're employed. Thanks for your time, and I hope you have a great show.
Chris, thanks so much for that call. What about you raised some of the ethical issues in your book. What about this specific one, the military application?
You know, Chris asks a terrific question. Let me first, just explain that, you know, pattern recognition systems that can identify us are actually quite powerful. So I think a lot of us think of face recognition. However, you can use systems now to identify people in many different ways. So your posture, your gait, even lots of different biometric pieces of data. So your temperature, your pulse, how hard you press down on the screen on your mobile device when you do certain functions. So this is just my way of saying I think a lot of us get fixated on facial recognition, and maybe this is not going to make everybody listening feel more comfortable. It might do the opposite. There's many, many ways beyond just looking at your face for somebody to figure out who you are. The military is also working on using radar in the field to do bone detection. So radar can be used in a way that doesn't destroy your soft tissue, but can reflect back out the shape of the bones in your body. So it's a way of, in a way without cameras, recognizing who's who and where. All right, now that everybody's probably sufficiently freaked out, let me address the question about the military and ethics. I can't comment on what the Pentagon is working on or building, but I can say that ethics is, you know, and rightfully should be part of every conversation on artificial intelligence. We don't have a globally codified set of values and rule, guardrails around how AI should be used in which circumstances. Every country is going to interpret things a little differently. And even here in the United States, we don't have a tradition of a chief ethics officer within companies. Now, that's starting to change. However, in the process, there are a lot of important decisions that are being made. So ethics, ethics needs to be a part of this conversation, but we also need to codify our values in a way that is meaningful and enforceable when it comes to AI. And one last thing on this, you know, our university programs are pretty rigid in how they teach computer science and AI. You know, it would be wise not to just include a single class on ethics, but to infuse all classes with ethics, and to ask students repeatedly to think through the downstream implications of the choices that they're making.
Chris, thanks so much for your call. You could be the next caller at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. We're talking about artificial intelligence, its development, and its possible impact on the future of mankind. In the United States, Amy, we've seen a number of tech company scandals and controversies. Russia used social media to influence the 2016 election. Facebook and Google have faced criticism for privacy concerns. Tech leaders have had to testify before Congress when these scandals have occurred. Should our lawmakers be paying much greater attention, and should there be greater regulation of artificial intelligence so that we can intervene before some of these problems happen?
So I'll answer that second question first on regulation. The answer is no. the problem with regulation is that it has to be specific, and it has to have an enforcement mechanism of some kind. Just this morning, there was some new data released from the Wall Street Journal about a related field. So this was robocalling. And in the United States, it's illegal to robocall under certain circumstances. The FCC and the FTC have been unable to collect fines that were levied. I think the total amount out of something like $200 million was only $6,000. So this, to me, is pretty analogous, because it would be the same. It's a good reminder that just because a law exists or regulations exist doesn't mean that they're being enforced. The challenge, and so that brings me back to regulation and the big tech and this sort of three epicenters of power in the United States. The problem with regulation is that, the technology is still moving pretty quickly. And for Washington lawmakers who don't have a deep and rich understanding of a lot of these technologies, to suggest breaking up these companies or regulating them in a punitive way, would mean that they have to change how they're functioning. But it would also mean that we'd have to have some means to enforce whatever those regulations are. The United States doesn't have its own R&D arm that's outside of the military. We do not have a national strategy on artificial intelligence, but we don't have a national strategy on many other fundamental technologies like genomic editing, as well. So we don't have a national point of view. We don't have offices set up. We don't have funding. And this is my way of saying that rather than lashing out at the big tech companies, we have to figure out a way to incentivize them, to do a better job of keeping humans at the forefront, and to do a better job of long-term planning. Suggesting regulation or coming up with punitive actions, I think at this point, is going to work against us. But this is a totally different approach. We're going to have to think of, what is a 2019, 21st century approach to incentivizing large companies to work alongside Washington, D.C., but also to collaborate in everybody's best interest, even people outside of the U.S.
We're just about at news time, and when we come back, we've got some callers who want to join us, and a lot more to come. Tons of questions. We could probably do several hours on this program, and of course, that's always a good problem to have. We're with Amy Webb talking about our future and technology. She's a professor of strategic foresight and the author of The Big Nine, How the Tech Titans and Their Thinking Machines Could Warp Humanity, and what responsibilities we believe that these big companies like Google and Facebook and others should be accountable to. How should governments regulate technology that is so integrated into the human experience? What about privacy? And how do we regulate information in our digital lives? These are huge questions, and we're talking about them this morning on The Morning Show with Amy Webb. Our conversation will continue after the news. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. Artificial intelligence is poised to change the course of human history forever, according to Amy Webb, author of The Big Nine, How the Tech Titans and Their Thinking Machines Could Warp Humanity. What do you think? How do you use AI in your everyday life? Are you even aware of how you're using it? Do you ever think about it when you use Siri or Alexa? You wonder if too much technology could be a bad thing, or who's minding the store in terms of what's being developed and for what purpose? Share your questions and concerns with us at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Amy Webb is with us. She's the author of The Big Nine, How the Tech Titans it's about how the tech titans are developing artificial intelligence and what that means for humanity, and we're discussing that. This hour, let's take a call from Sarah in Zion, Illinois. Sarah, good morning.
Good morning, John, and this wonderful guest. All of this just bothers me very much, and I personally avoided all that kind of appliances and whatnot in my life. I have two questions, and this is just, I realize it doesn't solve the problem, but I'm just wondering if I put my phone on airplane a lot, and sometimes I even take out the battery. Does that do any good in avoiding that kind of, does it take me off the grid in any way when I do that? And my second question is, I really believe that if we don't take drastic action on climate change, we are going to experience economic collapse. And therefore, I feel like, I wonder how that will affect the whole computerization of our lives. And will all these hyper technology advances come to pass or stick around if there's an economic collapse?
All right. Let's take those two questions. Talk about the can we go off the grid by removing the batteries from our cell phones, Amy?
Yeah, so those were terrific. Both of those were terrific questions. So the first one is a bit more tactical, so I'll address that one first. So the answer is no. Just because you turn your phone on airplane mode or you occasionally take out the battery does not solve the type of problems that you're concerned about. You know, by virtue of the fact that you are alive in the year 2019, you are generating, you know, incomprehensible amounts of data that can be mined and refined and, you know, productized and optimized and monetized in lots of different ways. So I know that sounds concerning, but I'm in the same boat. And, you know, I'm also somebody who is probably much more hyper aware than the average person about how my data are being collected and used. So, you know, I I'm a public person. I'm a recognizable public person. So that means I'm just careful. I am very careful about, you know, what content I post. I don't use social networks the way that most people do. I'm on Twitter, but I use it more as a listening post. And I would say the same is true of Facebook. I don't have Facebook on my mobile device. And I'm very cautious about the apps that I install. I have very, very few apps on my mobile phone. You know, but I'm also aware, and I accept the fact that, you know, my data are being used oftentimes in ways that are not fully transparent to me. You know, I think for anybody who's concerned, not getting a mobile device doesn't solve the problem either, because at some point you're going to have email, you know, you're going to want to buy an airline ticket and get a, you know, boarding pass. I mean, you know, so the good news here is that in 99% of the cases, the purposes that your data are being collected for are pretty innocuous. And, you know, so I would not be super, super concerned. That being said, I would try to be a much smarter, you know, I would try to develop some digital street smarts and also start to be much more skeptical. So, you know, for people who are using DNA tests, for example, to learn more about their, you know, lineage and heritage, you know, I think you should stop and ask yourself, you know, what are the additional costs of me participating in these services to find out what percent Irish I am? So that answers the first question. The second question is has to do with the environment and you know, technology writ large. So the book that I've written sets up this argument about AI, and it's really written for everyday people to understand what AI actually is and why it matters. And the second part of the book lays out some very visceral scenarios. These are stories that are optimistic, neutral, and catastrophic that explains what the next 50 years of our life with AI might look like. Those scenarios include how AI intersects with other, you know, parts of life, including climate change. And in the catastrophic scenario, you know, one of the data-driven stories that are told is, you know, what happens when our global food supply moves, when the jet stream shifts in different ways, and we wind up with global food shortages. We actually know that that's probably on the horizon. You know, in a catastrophic framing, AI is not used to help this problem, and in fact, it gets exacerbated by China. But in the optimistic framing, artificial intelligence can help us deal in a really positive way with some of the climate change and the implications of that climate change that we know are coming. It's already being used in China and Japan, who are working on really interesting indoor plant factories. So rather than growing lettuce out in a field where, you know, the lettuce is subjected to the elements, instead it's being grown in a massive, like, you know, 50,000 square foot indoor underground plant factory, where, you know, lettuce is being grown, and there's the numbers on this are staggering. It's like 90, it requires like 90% less water. There's extraordinarily high numbers of positive results. There's nowhere near the food waste that you would see on a traditional farm. And all of that is possible because of precision agriculture and AI.
We're with Amy Webb about the future of technology. She's a professor of strategic foresight and author of The Big Nine, How the Tech Titans and Their Thinking Machines Could Warp Humanity. Let's take a call from Ken in Beloit next.
Good morning.
Good morning, Ken.
I think your guest just answered a lot of my questions on our last call, but I'm just wondering, you know, you hear about artificial intelligence and what the Army is using, and I was just hoping, is there any companies out there, good companies out there, that are using it for humanity to, you know, I'm just on a local aspect around here, how we can use it to help out in our, like she talked about, in the food production or whatever. You know, there's so much that I think we can do, but we get scared because we hear all the things that are negative that the Army's using it for, like the radar detection of your detecting bones and all that other stuff and facial recognition. But hey, on a local aspect, is there anybody that's developing anything that they can just look at the deer herds in Wisconsin and detect which ones have chronic wasting disease and which ones don't before you have to kill it and cut the head off and send it in to find out if you can eat it or not?
And Ken wants to know is what's being done that's for the good of humanity?
Sure. Well, I mean, I can address the local issue. I actually went to summer camp in Oconomowoc, Wisconsin, and I'm originally from Northwest Indiana. So I get some of the local concerns. You know, agriculture is one place, and this is something that I write about quite a bit in the book. Agriculture is a really interesting place where AI can help everyday people, you know, sort of get along better. So there's AI being used now to detect fungus issues on trees. We're having we're probably looking at a collapse of certain coffee plants around the world. So the same type of technology can be used to detect changes in patterns and to see, you know, in areas where it might be difficult to look, if coffee plants are affected by the fungus. And certainly to your point about the deer wasting disease, you know, you can absolutely train a system to detect, you know, without having to get even near a deer population, which one of those animals is infected. Now, getting those tools into the hands of, you know, local people who would want to use them, we're not quite there yet, but we're certainly on the route to that. And that brings me to a really important point. These nine companies that are building the future of artificial intelligence, I don't think are evil companies. I think that they really do have, especially those in the United States, I think that these companies have have grand ideas and ambitions for the future. The challenge is balancing the power between the financial center, which wants fast returns and they prioritize speed over safety, Washington, D.C., which is gearing up for an election season, I think, and sees politicizing technology as a hot-button issue and a way to garner votes, and the tech sector, which has been kind of left alone for a really long time and doesn't, you know, doesn't want to change the way that it's working, you know, but would probably benefit if the investors would give them a break and let them keep their heads down and not force them to release commercial products every 5 minutes. You know, I think that we would see more products getting to everyday people to use them in ways that would help them if we shifted the developmental track of AI.
We're going to take a short pause here and come back, and we'll have more with Amy Webb and your questions as well at 800-642-1234. We're talking about the future of humanity and artificial intelligence on The Morning Show this morning. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. Stay with us. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. We're talking about artificial intelligence and its potential for something good to happen for humanity and also for bad things to happen, depending on how we develop it and what how we plot the course of our own future. Amy Webb is the author of The Big Nine, How the Tech Titans and Their Thinking Machines Could Warp Humanity. Let's take a call from Tim in Eau Claire. Tim, good morning. Welcome to The Morning Show.
Good morning. I was wanted to talk about a conversation I had with a friend about a year ago. We were talking about a new product in his business, and the next day I hadn't Googled anything, hadn't looked anything up. The next day I saw an advertisement for that very specific plumbing-related product.
Tim, thanks for the question. Amy, what about that? Are our phones listening to us?
So... this is a tricky one because we seem to hear, you know, I've certainly heard stories like that, and I know people who have experienced something similar. The inclination is to assume that our phones are listening, which is one possible explanation. What's also possible is that, you know, we are doing so much digitally, whether we are
doing internet searches or we are texting people about things, you know, it's become such second nature to us that we forget sometimes to connect all of the dots between all of those actions. So it's possible that the speaker, you know, I haven't seen evidence of this. It's plausible that the speaker could be on in certain circumstances and listening. What's far more likely is that predictive algorithms have mapped all of this activity that you've done through texting and searching and, you know, using different apps in different ways and also looking at what you've done off of your phone, like on a browser, on a computer. And a predictive algorithm has connected all of those dots and been able to triangulate a specific thing that you were, you know, talking about very recently. And even in cases where it may seem super, super obscure, like a really specific piece of equipment, which seems like, you know, impossible that a system would figure that out on its own. These systems are very, very sophisticated. And I would argue that you don't even need to have the speaker on your phone to listen in on somebody else's conversation. That would require much more compute power. That would be a much more, in many ways, difficult system to recognize everybody's voices and then retarget them and deliver them that information. So what's much more likely happening is, you know, what you're being shown is the result of your digital, connecting all of the dots between your digital actions.
Amy, you've taken your research on artificial intelligence to some of the most prominent decision makers, three-star generals, CEOs, White House leadership. How have they reacted? And did they agree that implementation of some of your strategies is necessary?
So the third part of the book that I've written is all solutions. And the argument that I'm making is that every single one of us plays some role in the future of artificial intelligence. So that is, you know, you and myself and my dad, you know, but also management within these organizations and certainly the White House as well and other nations around the world. In all of the meetings that I've had, in fact, I have one on Monday, a day-long meeting to talk about AI with some of our lawmakers. I think everybody's warmed up to this idea that we ought to do something. I think the challenge that we're all facing is our cognitive bias. I think our inclination is to sort of go back to what we already know. So heavy-handed regulation or, you know, outlawing technology in some way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what I'm trying to help everybody in this space see is that we need to come up with some alternatives going forward. And it's not just here in the United States either. We need to collaborate with other countries around the world.
And we'll have to leave it there. Amy, thanks so much. I wish we had another hour.
Sure thing. Thank you.
Amy Webb is professor of strategic foresight at the NYU Stern School of Business, founded the Future Today Institute, and is the author of The Big Nine, How the Tech Titans and Their Thinking Machines Could Warp Humanity. It's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about questionable cuisine.
We recently received listener questions from Joe and Racine and Mark in Madison. They wanted to know, what's the deal with cannibal sandwiches? Why do people eat them in southeast Wisconsin? WPR's Mary-Kate McCoy went to meet with a couple cannibal sandwich aficionados to find out more.
Imagine. It's the holidays, and to quiet your pre-dinner hunger, someone hands you a slice of rye bread topped with a thick spread of fresh raw beef, chopped onion, and a sprinkle of salt and pepper. Sounds great, right?
At first you look at it like, excuse me? I'm supposed to do what with that?
That was Jeff Zupan, operations manager of Bunzel's Meat Market in Milwaukee and a lifelong cannibal sandwich enthusiast.
Hello, Bunzel's. Yeah.
Around Christmas time, Bunzel's goes through over 1,000 pounds of raw beef and about 250 pounds of raw onions, exclusively for cannibal sandwiches. While southeastern Wisconsinites may be the more eager cannibal sandwich consumers, they've been spotted across the upper Midwest. Chef Justin Carlisle of Arden in Milwaukee remembers them from growing up on his family farm in Sparta, which he described as an initially terrifying ordeal. But Carlisle has since come around. He even serves a dish at Arden that was inspired by cannibal sandwiches.
We have beef tartare, and it comes up from me growing up with cannibal sandwiches and me being the youngest of three boys and completely terrified of this raw beef sitting on the counter when I was a child. So I would go along and never want to get made fun of, so I would take the ground beef and put it on my grandmother's deviled eggs and then eat it really fast.
This is the part of the story where I have to tell you, if you're going to prepare a cannibal sandwich, do so with precaution. And to help me is a doctor who may be a familiar voice to public radio listeners.
I am Zorba Pastor, and I do like cannibal sandwiches. But the problem is, of course, there is a risk with eating cannibal sandwiches. The best cannibal sandwich with the lowest risk is if you take steak or something like steak and you grind it up. The worst cannibal sandwich is if you simply eat ground beef out of a package, because then the risk of E. coli is greater.
Zorba says to let your butcher know you're using the meat for cannibal sandwiches. Ask for it to be freshly ground with a clean grinder.
All good.
So where did cannibal sandwiches come from? Their history in Wisconsin is a little murky, but Chef Carlisle says their story is likely one of practicality and tradition, going back to the Northern Europeans who settled in the state.
Especially being an extremely agricultural state, it is one of the necessities that you always had. You know, it's kind of like making cheese in Wisconsin, like you always had dairy and you always had meat.
Despite their history, the sandwich's popularity has plummeted. But at the butcher shop, Carlisle and Zupan talk about how they're seeing signs of a cannibal sandwich comeback.
I think that maybe we have a little ways to go before it becomes a staple back again.
In the Midwest, it's been always here. It's just sort of undercovers.
Like, everybody knows what it is, but nobody ever talks
nobody
about
wants
it.
To, nobody wants to call them cannibal sandwiches.
Right.
The old-timers do.
Right.
They come in and go, I want some of the meat for cannibal sandwiches.
Right.
The other people are, I'd like a steak tartare, or I'd like this or
right.
that.
Maybe when we get old enough to not care anymore, then yeah. we can do that,
we can
too.
We say whatever we want.
Right.
Carlisle and Zupan say one thing is for certain. Here in Wisconsin, the food culture is much more than burgers and fries.
A lot of the foods and a lot of the ways people prepared things and did things were lost for so many years. And everybody wants to blame it on the millennials. But it was long before that where it died off. And people, like I say now, are like, oh, gee, I remember when Grandma made this. And how'd you do it?
I'm very proud of our area, but there are things like the cannibal sandwiches, and now to have this come back, to me it means a lot, because otherwise we just become a commodity and the United States doesn't get any kind of differential of what areas and what immigrants and what styles were in each part of the United States and what history was there.
The story was by WPR's Mary-Kate McCoy and came from an audience question as part of the Wisconsin Project. Submit your question and we might answer it in a future Wisconsin Life segment. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Wisconsin Life can be heard in the morning show every Friday and Wednesday afternoons on Central Time. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. It's the morning show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.
Roberta Duran, 2x4x5, because it gives a mighty man an awful lot of money. Each state, each state, a big old...